In the 1980s, Charles Lewis was an investigative producer for America's enormously powerful current affairs show, 60 Minutes. That's the original show that the Nine Network modelled its own version of 60 Minutes from. Charles Lewis travelled the world, he broke many stories, but then in 1989, at the height of his career, he just walked away. Charles Lewis had become convinced that the US TV networks had lost their stomach for genuine investigative journalism, that there were just too many powerful forces in American life that the networks weren't prepared to touch. So Charles set up a not-for-profit media organisation called the Centre for Public Integrity, and it's still going strong today. Since its inception, the Centre for Public Integrity has brought to light countless abuses of power. One of their reports revealed how Bill Clinton's administration was rewarding major campaign donors with overnight stays in the Lincoln bedroom. And in 2003, for example, they published the secret war contracts that identified Halliburton as the prime beneficiary, the corporation closely linked with Vice President Dick Cheney. Hello, Charles. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Lord Northcliffe's famous saying that news is what somebody does not want you to print. All the rest is advertising. How do you like that, Charles?
That's a great quote. That sums it up in too many cases, I'd say.
Where did you start in journalism, Charles?
Well, I started in high school, actually, I had a mischievous column called Purple Haze. This is in the 1960s, the Jimi Hendrix song. And my sister and I, we were both president. I was president of the school. She was 2 years younger, president of her class. It was sort of a satirical look at the school, and from the principal to the teachers to the facilities, you name it. And we had an anonymous name. Martha Mumblesome was our pseudonym. So no one knew who it was to the last day of school when we revealed who we were.
Does that give you a sense of fun about tweaking the noses of the powerful or people in authority?
I confess, apparently it does.
Apparently it does?
There's a DNA thing or something, yeah. I didn't know it until that, and then I went to work at later places. But yeah, apparently that emerged over time.
You came from a conservative family, and you went to work for a while for a Republican senator in Washington, Senator William Roth. This would have been during the Watergate scandal? What did you see of that?
Yeah, it was. Roth was very interesting. He worked for Douglas MacArthur at the end of World War II, and he had 2 degrees in the same year, business and law from Harvard. I mean, he was a brilliant guy. But in 1974, which is the year the president of the United States resigned, Richard Nixon, I was an intern, and you'll love this, an assistant press secretary, speaking of flax, PR folks. And I noticed all the Republicans were wanting to hide under their desk or basically leave town, because the worst thing they could do, if they criticized Nixon, they would look disloyal. And if they didn't criticize them, they looked like they were in the tank, and maybe we should investigate them too. And so basically the best thing they could do was disappear, which was what most of them did.
And this is what a lot of Republicans are doing now with Trump, by the sound of things, isn't it?
You know, that's true now that you mention it. Yeah, it's true. But so it was a real eye-opener, but it was also a scary moment in the history of the country. And I love history, and I was there looking at the glistening evenings with the moonlight off the Capitol and all these great august buildings. And I'm a little bit of a, you know, patriotic guy, believe it or not. And I thought, well, what's going to happen to this country? You're going to get rid of the president. That's never happened in U.S. history. What then? And there was really a sense of drama at that. I mean, I have to tell you, that part of was also part of what was happening. And it was, and I also, of course, thought, who are these young cub reporters stirring up all this trouble? It was already starting to become a sensation about these two young guys doing this story, Woodward and Bernstein. And from that, in a most peculiar way, 5 years later, I'm working for Carl Bernstein when he's the bureau chief at ABC News. So I could not have predicted that, but what a period, though. It was really, I was also interested in going to politics, possibly. I had been president of my class, president of my school, and watching the Watergate scandal, and then with Bernstein, my boss, covering the Abscam scandal, where literally 8 members of Congress went to prison, the biggest scandal of Congress regarding corruption in U.S. history. Suddenly, the idea of public service kind of started to wane, I guess you'd say. So it was really an exciting period in my life, a really crucial period, because a lot of big decisions got made there. I don't regret any of it. I savor it, actually, sort of.
You wrote a thesis on an infamous coup that took place in Chile, South America, in 1973, when the elected government of Salvador Allende was overthrown in a coup that was pretty much sponsored by the United States administration. Henry Kissinger was behind it, the CIA were behind it. Allende was assassinated. It was a pretty ugly business. Why did that draw you in so much? Why were you so interested in that, Charles?
Well, there are two articles I read. One was in Newsweek about bodies piling up in the morgue down there. 3,000 people died in a matter of weeks, brutally, because of Pinochet. And this Newsweek article said, mentioned the U.S. naval ships being offshore and sort of quietly lending their support to Pinochet by being there but not being there. And the families, there were some Americans who died in that group, a small number, who wanted answers. And, of course, the Pentagon and the State Department for the U.S. would not tell them anything. It was pretty clear they were assisting, and we later learned they especially were assisting in all kinds of sordid ways. So that interested me. And then, of course, I knew that what had happened after that was a brutal, not only killing people, but then putting veneer on what had happened and trying to present it a certain way. And I...
Were you horrified by it?
I was totally horrified.
By your government's involvement? Because we all want to think our governments are good governments, don't we?
Well, we always think that. And it was the first time I realized, well, I had started... That was my little bit of an epiphany, that what public officials say, there are layers of truth by different levels of folks in government. Diplomats, for example, and presidents will say the vanilla, very happy stuff. And then the bureaucrats down there, you can barely understand what they're saying. And then from the midst of all that, somehow journalists and the public are supposed to glean, oh yeah, what the truth is. And usually that truth will emerge days, weeks, but usually years, and even sometimes decades later. And I didn't know any of this until I started exploring this. But I had no background in Latin America, international economics. I didn't speak Spanish. And in a way, this was nuts for me to try to do this. I wrote a 189-page thesis, and I interviewed Seymour Hersh, the great journalist who, you know, I was basically talking to God in my youthful idealism of the moment. And the other person was Orlando Letelier, the former Chilean ambassador.
Now tell me about him, because he's a key figure here, isn't he? This was a former ambassador in the Allende regime who lost power when Allende was assassinated and the government was turfed out. What was your dealings with him like?
Well, yeah, he actually became even more important because when Allende died and basically is pretty much considered now that he committed suicide, but he would have been murdered if he hadn't committed suicide. Orlando Letelier was the ambassador, and he had been talking with Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State, and basically Kissinger had been flatly lying to him and saying, we're not going to do anything to your country. We don't think there should be a coup. Meanwhile, they're helping to plan the coup with the Chilean military. But the other part we forget, after Allende was killed or died, killed himself, whatever, there was a vacuum. And the number two official right before this all happened was Letelier, became the defense minister, and that's the second highest ranking official. They put him on a rock. I'm joking, but it's not a rock, but a horrific prison down near Antarctica. And he almost froze to death.
Antarctica?
Yeah, because, you know, Chile, you know, it's a big, long country. And so it was a horrible, out in the middle of the ocean somewhere. And it was just like Devil's Island type story, scenario. There was fear he would die, and there was a humanitarian groundswell around the world, let this guy get, you know, pressure on the new Chilean Pinochet government. And so he was allowed to come to the U.S. And so he had become a professor at American University, but he had also was doing research. And yes, he was speaking out against Pinochet.
And did you meet with him and talk with him?
Yeah, and I went to his house, which was very interesting. And he's a very tall, erudite, a guy with a very trimmed mustache and very urbane and, you know, sophisticated, very nice man. Here I am, some kid in my senior year of college. That I could even get a meeting was amazing. To come to his house was even more amazing. And he showed me secret Navy cables in Spanish, showing that the U.S. was helping and sending signals, giving advice and stuff to Pinochet during the coup.
So you gleaned all that information from him. But what happened to him?
Well, what happened is I parked in his driveway. He said, I live on a cul-de-sac in Bethesda, Maryland. Just park in the drives. I park in the drive. 18 months later, I'm in grad school myself down in Washington, Johns Hopkins, and I start hearing sirens. And the windows are open because it's still hot at that time of year. And he had driven with two grad students downtown from out there, the suburb, and a bomb went off that shot all the people in the car and the car about 20 feet in the air. the sound was heard in the White House and the State Department, and he was killed instantly. He was the driver, and the two grad students were newlyweds, and the woman died instantly, and perhaps the cruelest fate of all, her husband was okay. He was in the back seat, and he had the he's still living. The rest of his life, he'll always have that in his mind.
So Pinochet's government authorized an assassination in the heart of Washington, a bomb so fierce it threw the car 20 feet up into the air.
That's right.
That's extraordinary.
It's unbelievable, and the government lied about it.
Whose government?
The U.S. government said that there was no evidence, and people, come on. No, I'm not making this up. And there was a new presidential candidate emerging named Ronald Reagan who was challenging Gerald Ford in that particular year, and they all started saying that it was actually the Cubans who had done it. And then it took years for this to be pieced together with evidence and prosecutions and everything. But the bottom line is it was ordered directly by Augusto Pinochet. So it was a hit job, an assassination on the streets of Washington. And I didn't have a little light that hit me right in the face, but it's pretty clear as I look back on my life that there was no way I was going to work in the government, work in a think tank. There was the only thing I wanted to do was look at deep, important subjects. And with a few months later, I end up at ABC News, lucking out 600 applicants, getting rejected, ignoring the rejection, pounding the pavement, getting in there and getting hired. But I realized that was a turning point in my life. I didn't want to work for the government after what they had done, and I didn't want to work for think tanks because I felt that they were fairly sort of on the edge of reality, doing thoughtful thumbsucker stuff that almost no one reads. And I thought, well, I just knew what I had to do, and I started doing investigations in D.C., and it was only 3 years after Watergate. That's the best part of all. So it was everybody wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein then. So it was really fun, I have to say. A very exciting time.
Being an investigative journalist, it seems to me, anyway, that it takes a certain kind of extreme doggedness, Charles. Like, you've got to do that work that is involved in the best kind of police work. The ability to sit down with an enormously fat and boring document and just go through every line item. How correct is that?
It's pretty correct. Mm. Some investigative reporters are more into so-called human sources, you know, the parking garage interviews or something, but
The truth is there's not that much drama in it, is
no,
there?
No, there isn't. That sounds glamorous, and it was in All the President's Men, the famous Watergate movie and stuff. But the reality is you have to – and the way I do stuff is I take 5 or 10 different primary record, government records and other records, and mesh them. And from all that, I'll start to see patterns. And I won't talk to a human – sorry, that's what I call it – until I have done all that research, because otherwise I could be easily bamboozled because I won't have done that kind of homework, you know, of research. And all the people that work for me, and I've hired hundreds of people over the years at the center as researchers and reporters and things, they had to do secondary first, read articles, see what everybody says, and then go into the real good stuff, the primary records. And then you can call somebody up, but don't call up the person you're investigating. Then you still go out on the outer edges and find, you don't want to hit the tripwire and have everyone close their doors and turn their phones off and not talk. So it's a little, there's a little cat and mouse element, but you have to know what you're doing.
And is there a bit of that involved in the questions when you finally do speak to that official?
Sure.
Insofar as, you know, the best kind of police interrogation is when the subject doesn't know how much you know.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
And you ask them questions for which you know the answers to already, and then see what they say. Is that part of it?
No, it is. And you know, when I worked in television at CBS 60 Minutes, one of the things a producer had to do was write the questions for the correspondent, and that was Mike Wallace, who was a pretty scary interviewer. People were terrified of him because he would rip your heart out, basically. And the producer had to prepare those questions and do all the stories. But here's what the other part is. There are some other correspondents at that very show who weren't into investigative. So on question number 6, somebody actually admits they killed their wife. And instead of saying, "You what?" they would read question number 7. they just weren't into it. They'd done zero research. They're not really caring, you know, honestly. So I've seen all these extremes. It is funny when you see something like that, but it kind of makes you grimace, too.
It seems to me a large part of your work as an investigative journalist is to ask yourself the question, who really has power Where does power really lie? Is that the enigma you've always been trying to solve with your work in a very large sense? Where does power lie in America?
You know, it's really interesting you're asking it that way, because that is what I do and it is what fascinates me. But I never set out and thought, I'm going to go do what you just said and find the power. But by what we have done, we've always ended up doing it. In other words, it wasn't as overt. It was more of an instinctive thing. Why wouldn't you look at that? You know that if there's like some PR person for a company, they work for the other people. They're just an employee. They work for the trustees and they work for their bosses. So, and they're also going to tell you that their person was not going to go on camera, of course. So you shouldn't even do this story. Welcome to television. And so you have to make a decision about how you're going to proceed. And each step is strategic. The worst thing you can do is get in too fast. Sometimes you get, especially with television, you get one shot of an interview or a question, literally one question. And if you ask the wrong question, or even you have three questions, but how you ask the questions, the timing of the question is everything. You know, most people don't really want to talk to you anyway. So there's a little problem there. So then I used to have to do stakeouts at 5 in the morning, and that was terrible. I didn't like that. I did feel I was invading folks' privacy. But you get one shot, and sometimes like they won't talk to you, but oh, by the way, they have to go leave the building and walk to the other building or something.
Australia has a kind of strange situation where we have a Parliament House which is full of politicians and some journalists as well. They're often in close quarters with one another, too close at times as well. Right. And they're often in the presence of powerful people. And I worry sometimes when I hear some journalists talk privately, I think, oh, you're a bit too impressed by power sometimes. Have you noticed the situation when a powerful person walks into a room, they have that gravitic power. People are drawn to them. They seem to sparkle a bit. And then once they lose power, it's like 10% of the air has gone out of them or something, and you notice the difference as well. Have you felt that, and how do you resist it as a journalist?
Well, it's really hard. I mean, by focusing so heavily on documents and actually just trying to understand the landscape in a kind of a broad way first, coming in macro and then into the micro, I generally am so focused on the substance that I'm not worrying about the interview. Because first of all, more often than not, now folks don't want to talk to you. It's just much easier to just not do it.
And when they try to charm you, though? When they try to sort of slather on the charm and then they begin to realize that you're not their friend?
Well, they seem to have stopped doing that charm thing. We've had vice presidents and cabinet secretaries and Senate chairs of committees in Washington call and plead with us and yell at us and everything, telling us not to publish things. And I've had my interns, these are kids 21 and 22 years old doing research, and they get a call from the former vice president of the United States yelling at them because of some impertinent question they've asked. But generally, we don't call people until we know what we found in records first. I mean, because then we know what actually, that's been sworn under oath, under law. It's been filed officially. It's already there. We're doing the courtesy of talking to them. We want to know what they have to say. But if they don't talk, we're going to publish it anyway. So in other words, I don't really get invited to White House parties or these kinds of things. I'm sort of seen as a pain in the you-know-where.
Yeah, it's okay to say pain in the ass on the show.
I didn't know if you're allowed to do that. I didn't want to be arrested here in Australia. Yeah, but that's how I'm generally regarded, except for my family most days.
Yeah. As you say, you went to work for some of the big US TV networks. You worked for ABC News for a while and then went to CBS's 60 Minutes. Oh, man, that's got to be heady to work on a show like that. It has giant, giant audience. And you have the pleasure of making a powerful story, putting it on the air on a Sunday night, and then on Monday morning, everyone's talking about what you did and said, and you left.
Well, it's true. No, I'll be honest. I was thrilled. And I got a phone call one day from Mike Wallace, who talks, I can't even do the voice.
Like that, right.
Yeah. Yes, down around your ankles. Mm-hmm. Man. It's like, right. And I thought God was on the phone. And and I moved to New York with a wife and daughter in 8 days to take a one-year contract with no benefits, because I knew this was like the equivalent in broadcasting, at least, of the brass ring. Even though New York costs a lot more than Washington. And I stayed there 5 years. And I was thrilled, and it was really exciting. And I learned a ton about the world, about television, about all kinds of issues. It was a seminal time in my life. I also came to see there are things I didn't like about it. There was the trickle-up theory. That was something that people said there for investigative reporting. They said, you can't really investigate a subject. That would take 1 or 2 years. You're supposed to produce 4 segments a year. And I said, well, I can't investigate the way I investigate 4 segments a year. And I go, that's the idea. So you should read all the newspapers and pick some good stories and interview some of the good characters. Make sure they're good on TV, though.
So that was the theory that newspapers generate the stories.
Right.
And then the networks, TV networks, disseminate that work. That's the idea?
Yeah. Well, that was, but it deeply offended me. And I just thought it was somewhat ripping off or just republishing in a different way. I wanted to do original reporting. I didn't want to do somebody else's story with a few video interviews. You know, to me, that was like a drive-by something. It just felt lightweight and bothered me. And then the other thing, they didn't want to always credit the newspaper. Some newspaper does a story, 100 or 200 stories, for 2 or 3 years, and then you're going to sweep in and interview 5 people and do a segment that 40 or 40 plus million people see. And I said, how can you not credit the paper? And they go, well, does it really matter? I mean, it's out there. And I said, it does matter. What if it was you? Would you want to be ripped off? So I always started to become this Pollyannish, or whatever you want to call me. I was always very gently, I'm a mild-mannered guy, but I would just say, really? I think we have to do this. And they go, you don't really think that, do you? And the ethics person would be there, and the lawyers and all the suits. And I said, yeah, I really think you have to. And so finally, they started to put up with me and think it was okay. But then I had some other issues that came up.
And it was time to leave.
Well, yeah. I had a story that was spiked. And I had more than one story, but there were 1 or 2 of them that just were stuck in my craw, and I just couldn't handle it.
Right, the story's close to the network?
Well, one was a famous guy about to become Speaker of the House, and I had a fairly good idea he was corrupt, and I had 3 or 4 feet thick worth of documents I had gotten in Texas, and I was ready. I had loaded. I had stuff, and they didn't want to do the story, Mike Wallace in particular.
Why? Why did they?
Well, to be fair to him, he had a very rough year. He was being sued over the Westmoreland case, a libel case, the biggest one in U.S. history against him. And he basically was under immense pressure. And the last thing he wanted to do was take on the next Speaker of the House and all the PR people and all the lawyers it wouldn't be so much lawyers because they're public people. But he just didn't want to do it. He didn't have the stomach or the stamina at that point, which I sort of, as a human myself, I
understand that, yeah.
Yeah, but the other one was there was a person in my story that was a close social friend on the A-list in New York of both Mike Wallace and the founder of the show, Don Hewitt. And whenever I would have the screening, they loved the story. They wanted the whole segment to lead the show, which is that most of my stories did because the edgy investigative always usually started the show. And they wanted to essentially take the name out of this guy. And they didn't want to say that because they knew that was obvious, not journalism, it was something else. I didn't frontally confront them because they have the power. So they would say stuff like, you know, this bogs down right here. I think it's a little slow. I think we really need to, if we could really just trim that down or just lose that whole paragraph. And I would say, I think it's great. I think it's terrific. And I was always a mild-mannered guy, but this one I was starting to get steely about it. And I still smile, but I'm like, I'm not taking it out. And it became clear, but I had an impasse go for like a month, which is a lot of time. And they want to lead the show with it, but we had to resolve it or it wasn't going to air. And finally, I realized I had to do something or that piece would never see the light of day. It'd get killed outright. And it still bothers me. I basically left the guy's picture in. It was 5 white guys, big fancy bankers, all millionaires and billionaires, wanting to sell parts of the U.S. like Rockefeller Center to the Japanese back when that was a very sensitive issue. And I thought it was kind of outrageous, and it looked like hell, and I wanted the world to see it, and I was going to put, anyway, we had big fights about it. Bottom line is, I took out his name out of the script. I proposed that, not wanting to, but if I was going to lose the whole segment, I said, okay, we're going to mention the company, we're going to show their picture, I'm just not going to say his name. And Don Hewitt, way to go, terrific, Chuck, way to go. And so it led the show, it was nominated for an Emmy months later. And the next morning I quit. I called up Mike Wallace and resigned. I sent a one sentence fax back when we had faxes to Don Hewitt quitting.
Broadcast, podcast, on your mobile. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
What did this mean for you? Because you would have been on a fabulous salary, living in a, probably a nice place, apartment in New York City. What did that mean for you at the time?
Well, it was basically nuts. I mean, I didn't have any savings, and my wife didn't work. And, you know, I was jumping off a cliff, basically. I mean, I realized how perilous it was, but I just decided I'd had it. I just was angry, and we had had lots of screaming matches and in the days prior to that. And I broke a four-year contract and walked away.
What was the reaction of your colleagues?
They all thought, including Mike Wallace, who called my wife, and they all said, is Chuck having a breakdown? they thought I was losing it.
And you thought they were losing it.
Yeah, well, I just didn't want to work for them anymore. I was really mad about it. There was something going on there. But of course, then the next question is, what are you going to do now? And I had lots of offers. The other TV networks, ABC offered, CNN came at me, and people in Hollywood wanted to do made-for-TV movies based on real-life stuff, but that didn't sound like my world. And I knew all the other places were going to be similar. And so I decided, I got two friends who didn't know each other, and I felt compelled to be in charge after what I just lived through. And all the good journalism names were taken, investigative reporters and editors, Center for Investigative Reporting was already created, and Fund for Investigative Journalism was already around. And so I couldn't use the investigative reporting or investigative journalism name. And I kept that thing. But the only thing that every story I've ever worked on usually involves integrity of some sort. So that's why I ended up with a sort of odd-sounding name of an organization, like an advocacy group almost, and because of the word for. But I thought, well, most journalists are for public integrity deep down, so that's so terrible.
Well, that's an interesting issue you raised there, because journalists, there's this idea, which is a bad idea, that journalists aren't supposed to be for anything. They're supposed to be neutral. Right. But surely they have to be for public integrity, for transparency, for truthfulness, for all kinds of things.
Yeah, I totally agree. But it was seen as... who are these people? Right. kind of thing. And it took two or three years and a few big scoops for the folks to get over that. And then they liked the name because it also gave, someone used this phrase, they said it gave spine to newsrooms because they wanted to cover stuff, but they needed someone who said, this is terrible. Because once we started doing several reports, and we did 300 reports and 14 books in 15 years that I ran it, we were developing a reputation and winning awards and all kinds of stuff. So we were starting to become known. And then journalists who were trying to get their editors to do stories, they said, we need somebody who knows something about these issues and you need to talk to them. And so they would call and say, what do you think about this? And I said, it's outrageous. And of course, they love that.
But wait a minute. That's so interesting. Hang on. Journalists have to go to you. This is outrageous.
And one of the former Washington bureau chief of the New York Times, who hired Seymour Hersh, who's an iconic guy, and he's sort of one of my mentors, I said, I feel kind of weird talking about these issues. We report. We're not supposed to do that. And he goes, no, you don't understand. They're going through a crisis. Their editors have no spine, and they're nervous to do stories. They need somebody to back it up and say, this is a real problem. And because of the name of your organization and what you've done, they need your voice. If you've already looked at that issue many times, why not do it? And I said, well, I guess. But it became a complicating issue.
So how would the Center for Public Integrity work? You'd find a story, investigate it thoroughly, and present a body of work. Would you then broadcast it or publish it yourself, or would you just offer it to other news organizations?
Well, this was back in the last century, as they say. The first reports, the first one was 200 pages, and we'd profiled all 75 top U.S. trade officials working in the White House over like 20 years. Well, no one had ever done that. The New York Times, Washington Post never even wrote an article about that agency, let alone going to all these officials. And we found that half of them went to work for foreign governments and foreign corporations, doubling, tripling, quintupling their salaries. And
so in office, they'd been negotiating supposedly on good faith.
Tough deals. And
tough
then they
deals. And then they'd leave and work for the very foreign governments they'd been negotiating with.
Yeah, the Japanese,
with.
The Chinese, whoever.
Boy, that
whomever.
Stinks. But yeah. Journalists felt that they couldn't say, this stinks.
They couldn't,
and they had
never done it either,
right.
The subject. But then when other stuff like this, revolving door, it's called, you know, cashing in, mm-hmm. when other things, because we started to do a few of these, then we're the experts on that problem, you know, and they've sort of started to become something resembling an ethicist or something, and I don't consider myself that, but I had been able to see what those things were and show how they don't work or do work, but what's out there, and no one had ever done it before, and we had the goods, we had the documents. Back to those documents. And if you don't have the documents, how do you know it happened? I once had a guy who, a fancy guy, making $1 million a year from Japan, and I met with him. He's very smug, and he said, well, I don't need to register because I'm advising. Now, I'm an economist. And I said, oh, I see. And I said, well, you may want to rethink that. And he said, why? And I go, well, it so happens the Japanese government mentioned your name in their filing. So now they've said that you've been basically working for them and being their megaphone before Congress, but you're telling me you don't need to do it. Are you sure? Within hours, he registered. And stuff like that is just fun, you know?
I mean, right. I suppose when you're talking to these guys, do you ever get that kind of, how dare you impugn my integrity, that kind of thing? When this guy's been bought and paid for
by a
foreign government.
Well, I totally do, but I'm so, what's the word, low-key, and in person, really, I kind of am, so I don't, I'm you could call me passive-aggressive, I don't know what it is, but I don't say it to their face, I just will, they'll read it later.
You looked very closely at the influence of major donors on the two big political parties in the United States, the Republicans and the Democrats. And things have reached an interesting stage with all that. You have a situation where there's been a Supreme Court decision in the United States, Citizens United, which has declared that campaign donations are a form of free speech and therefore need to be unregulated. What's going on with campaign donations in the United States? What are you finding, Charles?
Well, you know, there was a time, the Watergate scandal, where we felt compelled to create a Federal Election Commission and actually regulate money in politics and disclose it for the first time. Can you believe it? It didn't happen until 1974 and Watergate. But over the ensuing decades, certain folks and one party in particular, the Republicans, started to say there shouldn't be regulations. And the Republicans are the ones who almost changed their name of a party because of Watergate. They seriously thought of changing their name. It was such a humiliation. But they started to feel their oats 5, 10, 15 years later. That wasn't such a big deal anymore. And there was the court decision. There was an earlier one, 1976, before Citizens United, almost 30 years earlier, that said money is free speech, so a billionaire can run and spend as much as he or she wants. And that was the beginning of the problem. That, and then 30 years later, Citizens United, which allowed outside groups to come in and dump untold sums of money right before the election, trashing somebody, that was also seen as okay. And so all these laws started to melt away because of significant lobbying and forces at play. And it's not like the Democrats were all perfect either. They didn't really want to do it. They were holding their nose and pretending they cared about it, but they were doing the same things the Republicans were. So we're at a place now where the amounts are just through the roof. I mean, we now have more than half the members of the U.S. Congress, our legislative branch, more than half of them are millionaires. Only 5% of the American people are millionaires. So you can't run for office unless you're going to be willing to spend lots of your money with ads and campaign ads and all commercials, all that stuff. And it means certain people, the Abraham Lincolns and the Harry Trumans of the world,
don't get looking.
Who weren't wealthy, they're not going to run. They can't afford it.
The great problem, This American Life did a special hour on this issue of campaign financing. And they revealed that in the lives of most senators and congresspeople, they spend 2 days of every week in a party center, phone bank somewhere, ringing
calling
up,
center,
calling center, where they ring up and ask for donations. These are senators of the United States who are ringing up people, asking them for money. Who on earth wants to do that for a living?
Well, not many people.
No.
No, that's the problem. And
can we assume that people even like Elizabeth Warren are doing this in the United States or are having to do this?
Well, she is. I know her. I don't know everyone, but sometimes I encounter her. I knew her when she was at Harvard and I had a fellowship up there briefly. But she has to do it too. And she rails against all this, but she still has to do it. Well, you have to, because if you don't, usually the winner in a campaign or an election in America, usually, not always, but 90-95% of the time, the person who spends the most money has the most commercials, advertisements, flyers, door to door, all that stuff. And if you don't have money, you don't exist. And so that's how it works. So money and politics have become so intertwined as to be indistinguishable. And a person who might be the best person you could imagine ever serving the public anywhere doesn't have the money, then they're seen as not having an effective campaign. And the journalists play into this. They'll use terms like that. Well, Skinner data seems to be rallying a number of people in audiences all across Iowa or New Hampshire, but their campaign has almost no money, and they're not really developing an effective campaign. And that was always code for they don't have any money. And that usually meant you weren't going to even get the nomination or even for your senators.
So tell me, why wouldn't a journalist say they don't have any money rather than they don't seem to be running an effective campaign? I mean, it's this kind of polite, weird language
around.
Well,
it is. Well, those aren't investigative reporters. No. They are a different form of life. I'm joking. I call political reporters, and I did political reporting. I was my job one presidential campaign. Back in 1980 for ABC was to go around and predict who was going to win a month before in every key primary in New Hampshire and all these other famous places. And a trained monkey could do this. How many visits has a candidate made? How much have they spent? How much are the ads? What are the local polls show? And then, gosh, it's really going to be hard to see who's going to win.
It's half a day's work, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And then they'd go to the bar, you know. and I just thought, what in the world is this? It was like sports writing, you know, picking winners and writing who won last night. And it's just silly stuff. It's lightweight. They're not going to do investigative stuff, and that's not what they do. And so, yeah, political reporters I've always seen as literally a trained monkey could do it. I swear to God, and that doesn't endear me to those people. But
in the midst of all this, many politicians will say that, yes, I can ask for money, but that doesn't mean the donor wants a quid pro quo. They will actually say that.
They will. I've heard them say
it. And what do you think when you hear them say that?
Well, I don't want to get in trouble, but I would call that a crock. I don't know if that's it could be a crocodile. but it's basically... it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, there's a great line. There's a wonderful member of Congress who died of cancer, but he had this great line. And he said, if you're a member of the House of Representatives or U.S. Senate, and you've got a phone with like five buttons, and your assistant says, those first three or four are citizens, they just would like to talk to you about an issue they care about. And number five is they've given money every campaign, they want to talk to you. And then he would always say, and which call do you think he's going to take?
Yeah.
And that's how it works. First in line are the donors.
Well, that brings us to the great, big, monstrous, disruptive election campaign of 2016 for the President of the United States that we're going through at the moment. Trump is guilty of many things, but one of the things he's perhaps done that's beneficial is just to call that. I mean, Trump has been the first candidate to say, yeah, I'm a billionaire. I rang up Hillary Clinton. I rang up all kinds of politicians and wanted stuff done and donated money to their campaign. At least we can thank perhaps Trump for that.
I guess. I'm joking. I mean, he has been direct about it, but he is the first billionaire and primetime game show host that we've for 16 years that we've ever had run for president. We've had billionaires run, Ross Perot and Steve Forbes, who I've investigated, but we've never had a billionaire
and a reality TV star in one.
Yeah, which is an unusual thing. In other words, a national celebrity anyway, plus a billionaire. But there's a really interesting phenomenon happening right now, which most of the media doesn't really understand in Australia or the U.S. is Hillary Clinton is about to cross over the $1 billion money spent, first time in U.S. history that a candidate has raised $1 billion. And Trump, he's around half that number. And there is an old...
Sorry, just be clear on that. Yeah. Hillary Clinton is going to have spent $1 billion, which is twice as much as what Trump has spent.
Right, and let me explain it. There are these things called super PACs, these independent groups, so-called independent. They're related, they're cousins. No, I'm just kidding. They're people that are friendly with the candidate, but they're running another legally constituted thing but they can raise as much as they want, spend as much as they want. And the super PACs plus her contributions so far before the election are $947 million. And by the time they collect all the money right after Election Day, it's probably going to pop up over $1 billion. Now, money follows power, and so donors want to – why do they give money? They want to impress those in power. It's a very simple construct. And so they, about a month or two ago, have concluded that Trump's going to lose. And it's not hard to see. I mean, the polls are showing it. There are certain states that Republicans have won for like 40 years that
they're slipping away
for them as well. And they're noticing how the hemorrhaging that's going on with the voting support for their party, not just Trump, actually. And they're terrified it will affect the House and Senate.
Isn't this because Trump doesn't want to pick up the phone and ring up and ask for money? This is what I hear. This is what I'm reading.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me. I'm not an expert on Trump. And this one area I don't have any interest in being an expert on. But he doesn't have any interest. But what I mean about it, I think people know, and they've known for months, that it's not likely – ever since the political conventions, just looking at those two conventions and how they were put on, one had a sort of amateur hour quality where they had a guy from Happy Days, the TV show from 40 years ago.
And Chachi.
Chachi, and not a bad guy, I'm sure. But the other side had the president, the first lady, the vice president, all these heavyweights and other folks of stature of various sorts. So I think people started to conclude a certain thing there. But the idea that he is tapping, to be fair to Trump, he has tapped into enormous anger and frustration, particularly by folks who feel left behind, who feel that politics has become the financial elites and political elites becoming the same people, and they're mad about it. And you have high suicide rates, heroin rates, and stuff like this.
Oxycontin addiction, high unemployment. Yeah.
And so they're mad. You know, they're just plain mad. And they hear – this is a guy who's noticed it and pointed it out, and they think he's kind of a funny guy because he sticks it to the establishment. I get the appeal, but I think the donors see that – I'm nonpartisan, but I think the donors see that he's a bit of a loose cannon. I think it's that could be called a charitable statement even, but that he's unpredictable, but also that he has had a number of setbacks. That's another charitable word. Gaffes. Yes. He stepped in fill in the blank a number of times these last months. There's a great website called PolitiFact where they count the lies of candidates, everyone, both parties. And the really big lies are called pants on fire. And anyway, Hillary Clinton, according to their tracking, and they're nonpartisan, they've criticized both parties for decades. They have Trump four times more of these types of untruths.
Yeah, he's about to break the internet with his untruths, I think, at the moment.
They have all these women that have come forward in the last few weeks. I mean, you add it all up, it's really quite an extraordinary situation.
But going back to the story with campaign financing and about major donors, billionaires like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson, the casino bazillionaire as well, putting in a huge amount of money to their preferred candidates. There is this other model that's developing that was used by Barack Obama in 2008, Bernie Sanders this year, and I think you said Howard Dean before that,
right.
Where you don't have gigantic donors, but you have massive amounts of small donors, donations arriving through the internet. Does that give you some hope that there might be some other way? I think that seems like a pretty good way to fund an election.
No, it does. I mean, an example for this current election is Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders raised, I don't know what his numbers, I think it's between 50 and 100 million, but that's a lot of money for a socialist Democrat from Burlington, Vermont to raise and never have run for president. And he really gave Hillary Clinton a big run there. It was much closer than Hillary Clinton or any of her people imagined it would be. And yes, the grassroots financial thing using the technologies now of the web, that is exciting. And we've seen instances of it. The complicating thing with the Supreme Court, unfortunately, is all these outside groups because they're going to spend, I forget the numbers, it's third to half or more of all the money. It's actually not the candidates. It's all these outside forces. They're actually, the candidates become a bystander in their own play in a peculiar way. We have all these outside groups dropping massive sums of money into the campaign, buying ads themselves. American people are going to be subjected to something between 2 to 3 million political commercials by the time we get to Election Day. That's not unlike it was 4 years ago. It's just going to be higher and worse.
All the more reason to move to a non-swing state so you can be left alone by all this.
Or maybe Australia.
Maybe Australia indeed. Now, you were saying before the pants on fire index with Donald Trump. This campaign is fascinating for the sheer volume of lies that it has generated that the news media is struggling to keep up with, struggling and failing really to hold to account. And with certain elements within the Republican Party base, a substantial minority of those people, or a majority, in fact, of Republican voters, believe that your president, Barack Obama, was born in Kenya, is a Muslim secretly, and a socialist. All these things, which none of these things are true.
Right.
There's a whole lot of fiction in this separate, very fictional media universe a very large group of Americans believe in and don't want to know when they have the documentary evidence put in front of them. What do you make of that, Charles?
Well, this has been brewing for 50 to 60 years in America. It started in 64 with direct mail efforts for Barry Goldwater, actually, who ran and lost against Lyndon Johnson. And with each passing, and then Ronald Reagan's campaign, which emanated out of that, and all the way today, why I'm mentioning this is to develop a parallel universe of news that's, in their view, not biased, not liberal, whatever, but it is extremely conservative, and it has its own agenda and own bias. If you accept that the other side has a bias or doesn't, this group has a real strong agenda, and it is usually the Republican Party agenda over time, and that it became most manifest and obvious with Reagan, but it also kept on with Bush, both Bushes, and during the Iraq War and those kinds of things.
So you're saying the party establishment is riding a tiger here, pretty much?
Well, what's happened, and you also, of course, you had a guy propose that the Republican Party have a network, a guy named Roger Ailes, in the Nixon White House in 1972, but it doesn't happen until Fox News is created in 1990, I think, was the year. And as Fox started to be created, then you had this Republican media-centric world, which liberals have called the echo chamber, where they all say the same thing. Rush Limbaugh, this talk show radio guy in America. Mm-hmm. Some polls, this is disturbing, 10 years ago there was a poll that people thought Rush Limbaugh and Bob Woodward of Watergate fame were both journalists. And Limbaugh had higher numbers than Woodward. So you're starting... Limbaugh never investigated anything in his life. I mean, the idea, it's appalling. But
So what do you say then when you have such a large group of Americans living in a kind of fictional news world like that, and there's vast amounts of cash from major donors that are going into those news networks?
Right.
From an outsider, this looks like decadence. Does it feel like decadence to be in the middle of it?
No, it does to me. It's the strangest time in the history of the country, I think, and certainly in my lifetime. I'm not a spring chicken. I've never seen anything remotely like this. And everyone I know, regardless of their politics, feels the same way. This is a circus. We have a full-blown, bizarre circus. And the question is, what happens next? Because this is not going to go away. We're going to continue to have other circuses down the road. We have a farce going on with our electoral system that we've allowed to occur over decades. It's just gotten worse over time. And yes, the media is a part of this because the media, there's different things. We all call everything the media. There's only a few serious news organizations, honestly. Most of them are hysterical mouthpieces for interest. You know, National Rifle Association has its own TV thing. Everybody's now a journalist. The Pentagon. We'd have the Pentagon News Channel ever since the Iraq War. So suddenly the TV networks, it's just another TV place.
So there you are with documentary evidence. But really, it tells you most people want to glom onto something like Rush Limbaugh, don't they? Because he'll go with the grain of their prejudices. He'll go with the grain of what they think they already know. And here you are coming along, a very annoying man with documentary evidence that says everything you think so far is actually, wrong, and it's actually here in the documents. Your message is quite unwelcome in times like this, surely.
Well, it's true. And it's true also where there's a liberal media as well, you know, that is sort of the counter to that, that has been there for a long time, but also there's new counterparts now that have been created. So I'm a nonpartisan guy. I alienate both parties equally. And, you know, we've had lawsuits and we've defended them and they've been dismissed. So We just do what we think is right, and we hope somebody reads it. You know, we're not running for office. We're not worrying about ratings. You know what I mean? My job is just to lay it out there. And if people don't see it or don't want to see it or whatever, that's life. I mean, my job is to dig the stuff out.
It's been great speaking with you, Charles, and fascinating to get your insight from the inside and outside the beast of America at the moment. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. On air, online, and podcast.
Charles Lewis is the founder of the Center for Public Integrity in the United States. And since our conversation, there's the new controversy over Hillary Clinton's emails, which has erupted. I spoke to Charles last week when he was in Australia as a guest of Griffith University's Integrity 20 conference. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.